Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And did you hear Wael Ghanim, one of the organizers of the Egyptian protests, on 60 Minutes last night with Harry Smith? He was amazing.
They don't understand the social networking part, but they underestimate the power of the people. And, you know, at the end of the day, I want to say my final word is thanks to the stupid regime. You have done us the best thing ever. You have woke up 80 million Egyptians.
Again. So if you're an autocrat or if you're a dictator and you've watched what happened in Egypt over the last several weeks,
you should freak out. You seriously should freak out.
Dictators should freak out. That's Egyptian Google marketing executive and protest organizer Wael Ghanim speaking to Harry Smith on CBS 60 Minutes last night. So what exactly was what Ghanim called the whole thing before the revolution? How organized were those protest organizers? What business, what besides social media went into their success? What role did the U.S. play, and which Arab rulers do need to freak out now? To take a stab at answering some of these questions, I'm joined by David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times, who also does The Washington Report for our sister station, WQXR, every Monday. Hi, David. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good to be back with you, Brian.
And you and David Kirkpatrick have a fascinating long piece on page one of the paper today, or at least it begins there, on the anatomy of the revolution. And you seem to say that organizers in Egypt and Tunisia actually coordinated. Was there coordination across national borders for simultaneous democracy movements?
Well, there was, and I think that was one of the most interesting findings of all of this, and that great work belongs to my colleague David Kirkpatrick, who arrived in Cairo as our new Cairo bureau chief just a few months before this happened. You know, welcome to your new town, right? And what he discovered in the course of the reporting that the Times team was doing out there was that this was more than just a contagion in which one group inspires the next. There was, thanks to Facebook, other social networking elements, a lot of communication back and forth across the borders, because, of course, on the web, there are no borders. And imagine what a shock that must have been to the Egyptian authorities. I don't actually think they ever fully understood that. But to discover that an entire security system that they had spent billions to build that was completely focused, you know, on the inside, never even considered this nature of threat.
You even write that they worked with a Serbian youth group. Now, we're used to youth groups protesting globalization, but it sounds like they're using it too.
They are. And, you know, what we've learned about the internet is that, you know, the old think was when you would go with, say, President Clinton to China, back in the days when I was White House correspondent, and, you know, he would give his speech at Beida University and he would declare that the Communist Party would not be able to survive the internet age because people would, you know, learn their freedoms as they got out on the web. Well, what we've discovered is that some regimes, the Communist Party in China, chief among them, are extraordinarily adept at manipulating the system, learning how to monitor the internet, learning how to cut off access selectively, learning how to use the system to follow dissidents. Then there are some regimes that are clueless, and the Mubarak regime fell into the clueless camp, and it took 18 days.
Who are some of the names? We keep hearing about this as a leaderless revolution, but you name names of people who were the brains behind these protests.
There were individuals who were the brains behind it, and I would send readers to the stories because there are no names that anybody here would recognize, but they were all people who were young professionals, by and large, working in Cairo, frustrated by the system. Many of them had international experience. Obviously, all of them were fairly adept in the new technologies. And what was truly remarkable was that while they started off as the ringleaders, once they got things going, they used the oldest forms of communication. You know, a few of them put out some notices of a march on Tahrir Square, and the night before they walked through one of the poorest neighborhoods and least internet-connected neighborhoods in Cairo, just shouting out to open windows, and people started following them like the Pied Piper. So this was a real combination of extraordinarily high-tech organization and extraordinarily old, low-tech organization.
Let me play another clip of Wael Ghanim, the Google marketing executive, being interviewed on 60 Minutes last night.
If there was no social networks, it would have never been sparked, because the whole thing before the revolution was the most critical thing. Without Facebook, without Twitter, without Google, without YouTube, this would have never happened.
And, of course, Wael Ghanim, after his arrest and then release and his appearance on an Egyptian TV talk show, really became such a face of the revolution and helped propel it to its next level after the protests had started to diminish in number. And the numbers that were turning out to Tahrir Square, he was seen as such an inspiring figure that it really helped propel what probably was the final phase toward the ouster of Mubarak. Did Wael Ghanim play a big part before his arrest?
You know, he played a significant part in this small organizing group. But you could also imagine a situation in which a much more alert security system services had picked these people up much earlier. And, you know, in the end, while I believe the social networks were critical in organizing this and so forth, what was the deciding factor, Brian? I'd love to say that, you know, Facebook was protection against the military. But had the military decided at some point that they really were going to open fire on the protesters, they really were going to round them up, that this was going to look more like Tiananmen than any of the Eastern European revolutions, then I think we would have had a very different outcome here. And so just because the social networks get you organized does not necessarily mean that they are sufficient in overcoming the regime. And the evidence for this is Iran. There was another very social networked, very organized group of protesters in June 2009 when the Iranian election was largely stolen by President Ahmadinejad and his forces. And yet there was a military there that was willing to put it down with brutal force and succeeded.
David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times, is... long front page article today breaks down the anatomy of the Egyptian revolution and the U.S. role. And I'm curious if, based on your reporting, you think the differences between President Obama and the State Department were as big as they're being portrayed. What was going on behind the scenes here? It did look to so many people, no matter which side they wanted the president to come down on, that there was a kind of reactive, very incremental, very waffling kind of approach to the whole thing.
Well, that's true. And there was an inside game and an outside game here. And here I would send your listeners off to two different stories we've written. But one on the Sunday front page describes the dissonance within the administration as they tried to get their arms around what to many was the hardest issue, not whether or not Mubarak should come or go, but whether or not they should advocate that everything had to happen immediately, or whether they should take some time. Because when you go into a revolution like this, the most perilous period is the time we're in right now, when the government's being formed and when it can be hijacked by other forces. So Secretary of State Clinton was arguing for taking one's time and doing so publicly. Frank Wisner, the former American ambassador to Egypt, who the president had sent to talk to Mubarak, actually came out at a conference a little more, I guess, weekend before last, and said that President Mubarak had to be at the center of any change. Well, this was after the administration had already decided that Mubarak had to be marginalized. So On the public communication side, I would say they were not terribly well organized. Internally, I think they did better, and particularly when you look at the conversations between President Mubarak and President Obama, and I recount one in this morning's story where President Mubarak on Tuesday, 10 days before his fall, tells President Obama that this was just like some uprisings that were faced by President Nasser back in the 50s. And President Obama said to him, you know, sir, I respect you, I respect my elders, but this is different. And just because things went that way in the past doesn't mean that they'll go that way in the future.
So what was the U.S. role in all of this? Did any of the protesters get support here?
I don't think the protesters got support. I think the military got support from the U.S. The military was making a constant calculation through this entire process, Brian. Here they were a creature of the Mubarak regime for 30 years. All of their senior appointed officers were appointed by Mubarak. But they saw what was happening on the street. They saw that their leader was 82 years old. They knew that there would be enormous opposition to having his son, Gamal, take over as his successor. And so they initially played this neutral role, and I'm sure we'll discover over time that there were very varying decision opinions within the military. But you saw this outreach that took place from Secretary of Defense Robert Gates to his counterpart, to Mike Mullen, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, to his counterpart, and then down through the ranks, because so many Egyptian military officers have been trained in the United States, and they got to be friends with officers of similar rank in the U.S. military, and they're emailing each other, they're talking to each other, and the American message is, if you want to preserve the bond with the Egyptian people, you're going to have to stay out of this and perhaps protect the protesters. And in the end, that argument won. Now, what we don't know was that 10% of what was going on, 20%, 30%? Would it have gone differently? We don't know. But after President Mubarak gave that very muddled speech on Thursday night, this past Thursday night, the U.S. message to the military was he didn't answer the mail. And by the next morning when we all woke up, the military had told Mubarak that he was going off to his summer home in Sharm el-Sheikh.
So you think there was a chain of power there where the U.S. was able to push the Egyptian military and the Egyptian military was able to push Mubarak?
I think the U.S. was able to pull the Egyptian military, not push it. I don't think the U.S. could have pushed the military into the decision to retire Mubarak. But I think they pulled them back from the temptation to shoot at the protesters. And, you know, at that moment, 10 days ago, when it was clear that the military was not willing to shoot the protesters, that changed the entire balance of power. That was the day after, you know, that horrific scene of the goons who were going through Tahrir Square on camels and horseback and so forth. And at some point, the military stepped in the next day and just separated the two sides. And once it was clear that the military was at least going to protect the protesters, then I think it was only a matter of time for Mubarak.
David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. His front page article breaks down what happened along the way to the resignation of Hosni Mubarak on Friday. David, I want to ask you about a couple of things going on today in a few countries, and they do kind of revolve around this theme of who's willing to shoot the protesters and when, and also circle back to Egypt, where the army is now taking a stand against some protesters. But first in Iran, this in a little while ago from Tehran via the AP, it says eyewitnesses report that sporadic clashes have erupted in central Tehran's Engelhaba Revolution Square between security forces and opposition protesters. The demonstrators were chanting death to the dictator, referring to the country's hardline president that the opposition believes was reelected through fraud in 2009. Iran's opposition called for a demonstration today in sympathy with the uprising in Egypt, but tear gas was used to disperse the protesters. Witnesses report that many have still gathered in nearby Engelab Avenue. Iran security forces cut phone lines and blockaded the home of an opposition leader in attempts to stop him attending the planned rally. What do you make of what's happening today in Iran?
Well, Iran is the case where, as we indicated before, there's very little doubt that they're willing to shoot in prison protesters. And the numbers that you're hearing of these protests in Iran are much smaller than what we saw in Egypt. But more importantly, they're much smaller than what we saw during the protests in June 2009. So I think Iran is going to be a tougher case. But for the Obama administration, there's great value in it. You know, you saw the White House issuing these statements over the weekend that basically taunted the Iranians, saying, well, you supported the uprising in Egypt. And of course, the Iranians did because they thought it would lead to an Islamic government. But as soon as their own protesters began to also embrace the protests in Egypt, the Iranian government rethought the proposition. And so the U.S. position has been, well, what you said was good for the Egyptians must certainly be good for you.
Does the U.S. have more of an active role to play than that?
I'm not sure that it has a significantly more active role, except for the State Department money that has been spent to help keep technologies open and available to the protesters, from Twitter to other networking and communications elements.
Because there are, I ask because there are people now saying that President Obama should regret how timid he was in the summer of 2009 in supporting those pro-democracy protesters in Iran. Now, I actually remember hearing him get praised a fair amount at the time, because if it seemed like the U.S. was directing the process or trying to own the process, then it might have turned the Iranian people the other way. But now there's the second guessing about the U.S. not being strong enough in 2009. How strong is that second guessing in the White House this morning, and how do you think it informs what they do with respect to Iran at this time?
Well, certainly there's a different view in the White House about supporting democracy movements generally. I think 2 years ago it seemed too much like the Bush democracy agenda. Post-Egypt, it probably seems more attractive. But at the time in 2009, I remember interviewing many members of the administration about this at the time. Their deepest concern was that the minute that they stepped in on behalf of the protesters, the Iranian government would say, see, this entire protest is being organized by the great Satan, and use it as the excuse to crush it and just declare that all of those on the streets were agents of the United States. So I think that there was some wisdom in holding back, even though many did not like that at the time. Now, it's going to be more complicated now because the regime has shown itself for what it truly is, and because we're at a very different point in the Iranian nuclear program as well.
Let's keep going around the region. This in a short time ago, from Ramallah in the West Bank via AP, the Palestinian prime minister has dissolved his cabinet in a new gesture that appears to be inspired by unrest rocking the Arab world. And they had already announced new presidential elections in the last day, as well as parliamentary elections announced last week. How deeply is this shaking the Palestinian leadership?
Well, one has to think that the Palestinian leadership's biggest problem is its failure to deliver many goods to the people, although I think you'd have to say that Prime Minister Abbas has done a better job of that than past Palestinian regimes. And that, at the core, was what prompted the Egyptian Revolution. Remember, the Egyptian Revolution was not about Islamic revival. It was not about death to America. It wasn't even about Israel-Palestine. It was about the failures of the Egyptian state, and that's what made it seem so authentic. But in the case of the Palestinian Authority, there isn't really an overarching authoritarian state. I mean, the Palestinian Authority has always struggled with weakness, not strength.
Now to Algeria. We had former ambassador to the region, Thomas Pickering, on last hour. And he worried out loud that Algeria is a country where unrest is developing. People want democracy there, but that perhaps is a country that really is willing to open fire on the protesters and have a Tiananmen Square.
Absolutely. Algeria is certainly a case of that. And, you know, if you go into the reconstruction of events that we have in today's paper, there's a fascinating little back and forth between the U.S. and the Saudis, where the Saudis were telling the U.S., you've got to back Mubarak unilaterally, no matter what, even if he uses violence to put down the protests. So that that leaves you with very little question about where the Saudis are as well.
I guess. Although I heard an analysis this morning that said a similar movement is unlikely to be able to gather steam in Saudi Arabia just because it's a very big country physically with a relatively small population. And there aren't the population centers like Cairo with a Tahrir Square, for people to really gather in and stage a similar kind of in-person movement.
I think that's right.
So how would democracy ever come to Saudi Arabia?
Well, I think it would be a tougher run in Saudi Arabia, but it's also a fairly open society because, you know, the Hajj to Mecca is there. So you have a lot of influence of outside Arab states as well.
Mm. And finally, back to Egypt, where, again, from AP, short time ago, Egypt's ruling military council has issued a new communique calling on labor leaders to stop strikes and protests to allow a sense of normalcy to return to the country. The communique, read out by a military spokesman on state television, came as thousands of state employees, from ambulance drivers to police and transport workers, protested today to demand better pay and conditions. Egypt, it says, is in the midst of a growing wave of labor unrest unleashed by the uprising that ousted Hosni Mubarak from the presidency on Friday. So, aha, this isn't just about we want the right to vote and not have a police state. There are real gritty economic issues here.
There are, and I think part of the difficulty that you're going to see in all of these states, but starting in Egypt, is you have many workers accustomed in many ways to a pretty socialist state. I mean, authoritarian, but a state that has never allowed sort of free capital inflows and competition. And that may not be consistent with the desire of many people to be able to raise wages. You could see the government be in a position of feeling forced to raise wages. You saw President Mubarak last week announce a 15% increase in the salaries of all government workers as one of his last desperate efforts to stay in power. But it's not clear at all that the government can afford that kind of thing, and it's not clear at all that the economy could more broadly as well.
Last thing, and you may be hearing this for the first time, an official, now I'm looking at it, trying to find out, see where this comes from. Somebody, forgive me, I thought I had this, and now I think I don't have this, but I think somebody in the UK, British officials perhaps, are saying that, oh, here it is, it's Egypt's ambassador to the United States, says Hosni Mubarak may be in bad health. The first word on the 82-year-old ousted president's health. What would be the point of saying that now?
You know, he's been in bad health for a while. And, you know, he was off for treatment a year and a half, 2 years ago that we never fully understood in Germany. And so we don't know what kind of shape he's in. He looked better than most people expected when he showed up on TV a few times over the past 2 weeks. This goes to a couple of issues. One is, are the Egyptians going to let him stay in the country and live out his days? Secondly, are they going to go after his money, which almost certainly they would? They're supposed to be worth several billion, if not tens of billions, depending on whose numbers you believe. And that's pretty good pay if you've been an Air Force officer and president of a country for 30 years. It does make you wonder where that came from. And the third issue is, would they put him on trial? And maybe this is part of an effort to say, he's elderly, he's sick, leave him alone.
Interesting. All right, we'll leave it there. David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times. His latest book is The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power. And you can hear his Washington report on Mondays on our sister station, WQXR. Thank you for the insights, David.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Up next, excerpts from the WNYC Black History Month special, Back of the Bus, and then we'll begin a week-long series on the five films nominated for the Best Documentary Oscar. Today, Wasteland, about an artist in Rio who works with people who live picking through the garbage there. Stay with us.